Chapter 24 Reckless New World. Author's note. In the year 2020, the story of vaccination took a very personal turn for co-author Peter McCullough, MD, who wrote the following chapter in the first-person point of view. I was born in 1962, 14 years after the diphtheria, tetanus, and cellular pertussis vaccines were combined into a single injection, DTP. By the age of 2, I had received 3 DTP, 3 Salk-injected inactivated polio, IPV, and 1 live measles vaccine. While IPV protected the vaccinated child, it did not stop the polio virus from spreading between children. Between the ages of 2 and 16, I received 4 oral polio vaccines, OPV, for extra good measure. My parents believed that if any disease was worth preventing, it was polio. Visions of the iron lung machine and paralyzed children guaranteed that the McCullough boys were double covered for polio. The biggest health threat I faced as a child was recurrent streptococcal tonsillitis / pharyngitis, which caused my tonsils to swell to the size of golf balls. I was suffering the same fate as my Irish immigrant forefathers, which placed me at risk of serious damage to the heart valves and kidneys. My great-grandmother died at age 32 of Bright's disease, or post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. My grandfather died at age 56 of complications after mitral valve surgery, for post-streptococcal rheumatic mitral stenosis. To this day, there is no vaccine for post-streptococcal diseases. On the advice of my doctor, I underwent a tonsillectomy to break the chain of streptococcal damage to my lineage. My surgery, in 1969, followed by several days of inpatient recovery, has been the only hospitalization of my life. I went on to have fewer sore throats and no organ damage from strep infections. Nowadays, tonsillectomies are rarely performed because infections are rapidly diagnosed and treated with antibiotics. Even with no vaccine, the problem is well managed. During my career as an internist and cardiologist, I fully participated in routine vaccination and amassed a total of 69 dose administrations, including annual influenza vaccines. Hepatitis B and MMR vaccines were strongly encouraged by hospital human resources. Annual influenza vaccines were compulsory. Indeed, the influenza vaccine became the most important regulatory feature of my work, more so than even keeping timely medical records. If I failed to produce documentation of my annual flu shot, I would be kicked off hospital staff. However, apart from once being annoyed at the inconvenience of needing a flu vax on New Year's Eve, I never perceived vaccines in a negative light. On the contrary, every time I saw invasive pneumococcal sepsis with fulminant pneumonia, pleural and pericardial effusions, and the destruction of heart valves, I reckoned that if even one terrible case could be avoided with the pneumococcal vaccine, the program was worth it. Sometime around 2010, I read a story about a young, dashing, British gastroenterologist named Andrew Wakefield, who had been discredited for his publication on the MMR vaccine and the development of childhood autism. At the time, I assumed his punishment, stripped of his academic rank and medical license, was deserved, though perhaps too severe. Shortly before the COVID pandemic, I made a trip to India for which I took the hepatitis A and typhoid vaccines. Around that time, my brother told me about a colleague at his investment firm who took several vaccines for a work trip abroad and quickly developed Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS, which left him paralyzed, bedridden, and permanently disabled. I took consolation in the thought that such devastating side effects must be very rare. As we document in our book, The Courage to Face COVID-19, preventing hospitalization and death while battling the pharmaceutical complex. My experience trying to treat patients during the pandemic prompted me to re-evaluate our healthcare system. Especially disturbing was my perception that the system was ruthlessly suppressing the early treatment of COVID-19 to promote a new generation of untested, highly experimental messenger RNA, mRNA, vaccines. On July 22, 2020, the U.S. Department of Defense issued a press release that opened with the following paragraph. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Defense, DOD, today announced an agreement with U.S.-based Pfizer Incorporated for large-scale production and nationwide delivery of 100 million doses of a COVID-19 vaccine in the United States, following the vaccine's successful manufacture and approval. The agreement also allows the U.S. government to acquire an additional 500 million doses. How did the DOD already know that Pfizer's vaccine would successfully complete its trials for safety and efficacy? The Phase 2/3 clinical trial hadn't even started yet. To me, the press release raised the suspicion that approval of the vaccine was a fait accompli. I got the eerie feeling that the people running the HHS and DOD had already decided it would be approved, regardless of what the trials revealed. Later, I read the whistleblower testimony of Brooke Jackson, a trained clinical trial auditor who, in September 2020, worked at the Ventavia Research Group, one of the labs contracted by Pfizer to perform the trials. In her 15 years of experience, she had never seen such gross violations of safety and data integrity protocols, and yet, the lab's directors showed little interest in correcting the lapses. On the morning of September 25, 2020, she emailed the FDA to report her concerns and was fired from Ventavia that afternoon. A few days later, an FDA inspector called to discuss her report, but the agency apparently took no action. All this odd behavior suggested that all parties involved were merely going through the motions of performing a clinical trial of Pfizer's vaccine candidate. Operation Warp Speed struck me as a reckless gamble with the health of mankind, and in August 2020, I published an op-ed in The Hill titled, "The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program." As I pointed out, the monolithic emphasis on vaccination impaired and even prevented research on treating patients who were already suffering from acute illness. Most hospital deaths could have been prevented by the prompt administration of early treatment at home. In December 2020, I thought it very strange that COVID-19 vaccines were rolled out to hospital staff before nursing home residents received them. I witnessed young, healthy doctors and nurses rushing to get the shots while elderly patients were still falling deathly ill from the novel coronavirus. I was contacted by hospital staff to go to the lobby for my COVID shot. I replied that I'd already had the symptomatic illness, confirmed by a PCR test, and therefore didn't need a vaccine. Indeed, getting the shot after I recovered from COVID-19 risked triggering a dangerous, exaggerated immune response. After the vaccine was rolled out to the public, I received numerous reports of patients who suffered grave adverse events when they were senselessly pressured into getting the vaccine after they recovered from COVID-19 illness. This was just one of many examples of tried-and-true medical practice being thrown out in the mad rush to embrace the new vaccine, which was represented as conferring better immunity than natural immunity. This struck me as an extraordinarily fanciful notion. Since Jenner, the entire vaccine enterprise was predicated on introducing a weakened version of a pathogen to the body to induce its immune response. The COVID-19 vaccine was designed to instruct the deltoid muscle to produce the spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 virus to induce the body's immune response to this protein. How could this convoluted process produce better immunity than exposure to the virus and all its antigens. This notion implied that the novel technology did not so much activate the human immune system as improve it, suggesting that its designers had somehow transcended nature. To my great surprise, hospital staff continued contacting me for weeks with the aviso that I should get the shot anyway. That's when it hit me that the aim of the entire pandemic response was directed at that goal of global mass vaccination. The emergency countermeasure vaccine was a novel genetic biotechnology whose duration in the body and effects on the body were unknown. Though the motive remains unclear, it seemed that some overarching power had deemed it imperative for everyone to receive the shot. I found this utterly stupendous. Never in the history of modern science-based medicine had my profession claimed that a drug was suitable for everyone with zero contraindications. Events in the winter and spring of 2021 reminded me of Aldous Huxley's 1931 novel, Brave New World, about a dystopian world state that engineers and controls every aspect of human life. Taking their cue from our public health agencies, our government representatives and our media told us daily that COVID-19 was something like the dominant natural force on Earth, and that responding to it was the key organizing principle of public policy and society. We were, it seemed, in a state of total warfare against the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and the only weapon at our disposal were the new mRNA vaccines. From my perspective as a doctor who'd been practicing medicine for over 30 years, we had entered not a brave but a reckless new world. Scarcely a day went by without news of another time-tested principle of safe medical practice being tossed by the wayside. Especially stunning to me was CDC Director Rochelle Walensky's April 2021 conversation with Dr. Eric J. Rubin, editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, in which she vehemently advocated COVID-19 vaccination for pregnant women, even though it hadn't been tested on pregnant women. This was a flagrant violation of the golden rule of pregnancy, namely that novel and/or potentially harmful substances are never used when new human life is being formed and nurtured within the womb. For my entire career, I'd taken for granted that we'd already learned this lesson the hard way from the diethylstilbestrol, DES, and thalidomide disasters. After Walensky's approval, millions of pregnant women who wouldn't have dared drink a solitary glass of wine lined up to get an experimental genetic shot that had been developed at warp speed. Almost as alarming was the FDA's October 29, 2021 decision to authorize the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use in children 5 through 11 years of age, revised in June 2022 to include all children 6 months and older. By then, it had become abundantly clear from the CDC's own data that COVID-19 illness posed virtually zero risk of hospitalization and death to young children. Indeed, I repeatedly observed children who have a large and very active thymus completely recover from COVID-19 infection less than 48 hours after the onset of symptoms. Likewise, by the beginning of 2021, it had become abundantly clear that COVID-19 illness posed virtually zero risk to young athletes in top cardiovascular condition. Nevertheless, most college and professional leagues forced them to receive the experimental injections to participate in their sports. As a cardiologist, I found it the cruelest of ironies that while such athletes were at the lowest risk of suffering severe COVID-19 illness, they, especially young males, were the highest risk cohort for suffering vaccine-induced myocarditis or inflammation of the heart muscle. The first case of fatal, autopsy-proven mRNA COVID-19 vaccine myocarditis was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine on August 18, 2021. This should have put a hold on the entire vaccine campaign until vaccine myocarditis was thoroughly investigated. A few days after the FDA announced it had approved the vaccine for children, I received a report on the deliberations of the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee about the decision. Attending the meeting was committee member Dr. Eric Rubin, an adjunct professor of immunology and infectious diseases at Harvard University and editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. As was revealed in the transcript, Rubin said the following: "This is a much tougher one, I think, than we had expected coming into it. The data show that this vaccine works and it's pretty safe. And yet, we're worried about a side effect that we can't measure yet, but it's probably real. And we see a benefit that isn't the same as it is in older age groups. The side effect is myocarditis. By then, significant data had emerged that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines presented an elevated risk for young people, especially male adolescents. I was already seeing it in my clinical practice. A benefit that isn't the same as it is in older age groups was Rubin's mealy-mouthed way of saying that young people have a much lower risk of severe COVID illness. After acknowledging the myocarditis risk, Dr. Rubin made the following statement: So, for me, I think it's going to revolve around two questions: whether there is going to be a use for this vaccine in this age group, and then how the decision gets made within this age group. It's a very sort of personal choice. If I had a child who was a transplant recipient, I would really want to be able to use a vaccine, and there are certainly kids who probably should be vaccinated. The question of how broadly to use it, though, I think is a substantial one. But I do think that it's a relatively close call, but we're never going to learn about how safe this vaccine is unless we start giving it. That's just the way it goes. That's how we found out about rare complications of other vaccines like the rotavirus vaccine. And I do think we should vote to approve it. But we're never going to learn about how safe this vaccine is unless we start giving it. What kind of reasoning was this? The statement struck me as reckless, bordering on criminally insane, and as I read it, I'd never been so appalled. What could account for this monomaniacal desire for everyone, regardless of their risk profile, to get the shot? It was as though the public health agencies, medical profession, and public were in the grip of some wild enthusiasm for a new and untested technology. Often, I was struck by the thought that this mania was akin to a new religion.